Let's turn our attention back to the book of Ruth, chapter number 3, verse number 14, where Ruth, at her mother-in-law Naomi's prompting, has effectively asked Boaz, after 3 months of them being in close relationship with one another, would you please marry me? Would you please redeem my husband, my late husband's family line, by becoming my husband? And Boaz agrees. He is pleasantly surprised, I think. It had never really dawned on him that she would be interested in marrying him. But she's made that clear that that's what she wants. So he knows that there's one other guy in their family that is available, that is closer in the family line to Naomi's son, Ruth's late husband, than Boaz is. And so that has to be dealt with. So Boaz tells Ruth, just lay down, get some sleep here, and then we'll take care of it in the morning. I promise you in the name of the Lord, I'll get this resolved. I will marry you if I possibly can. So that's where we left off. Verse number 14 of chapter 3, so she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. He said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And that almost sounds like he was talking to some of his employees to basically say, keep this under your hat. I don't want this information getting out anywhere. There's no impropriety that has taken place here. This is all very on the up and up. I think he may be a little bit more concerned that word might get out to the other guy that he wants to deal with. So in the morning, he said to Ruth, bring the garment you're wearing, hold it out. So she's got her own little outer garment that she wears, and she would have used it as her own blanket that night. So she lays it out there, holds it out there. He measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Now, we don't know which particular measure of barley this is. It's certainly not an ephah. That's too big for her to have 6 of them bundled up in a garment like this. So it's probably some portion of an ephah. An ephah is a good 22 liters of dry grain, and that's actually what she measured out when she first started gleaning for him. So whatever the amount is, it's a pretty good size bunch of grain, but not too much that it's hard for her to carry home. So she went into the city. That's where she and Naomi are living. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Because remember, Naomi is like invested in this. I love Naomi's change in this story. She starts out the story very depressed, and she feels that God has been mean to her and treated her bitterly, and she doesn't even want to think about God anymore. But now, over the last several months, she has been invested in getting her daughter-in-law married off to this Boaz guy. And it seems that she couldn't wait any longer as the harvest season was drawing close to an end. And she finally teaches Ruth what it would take to get Boaz to make the proposal. And so she now wants to know, how did it turn out? Did it work? That's basically what she's asking. Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And so Naomi replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. So Naomi is happy about how this is turning out. She is convinced this is where it gets taken care of. Chapter 4. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. Walled cities always had gates, and particularly one gate was opening onto the plaza where they had their market days, where everybody brought things that they were going to sell and people would buy the stuff that they needed, and there'd be exchanges and things of that nature. And so that particular gate was also the place where a lot of business transactions would take place. And so that is what Boaz is up to, is that he wants to make a business transaction. So he goes up to the gate, he sits down there. Behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. Not surprising. This is a very busy place for the city. Everybody that has business goes in and out of this place pretty regularly. So he spots his own relative that is just slightly closer in relationship to Ruth's late husband. And he grabs him. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend. Sit down right here. So he turned aside and he sat down. And then he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So these are the older guys in the community, probably retired from heavy physical day-to-day activity. Now they're the ones that everybody depends on for training and advice. And so these guys end up from time to time being asked to be witnesses to business transactions. So that's what the point is. So they sat down. Then Boaz said to the other redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So the idea here is that Naomi wants the family farm, the property that her husband Elimelech kind of abandoned when they took off to Moab. She wants it all to be resolved financially. And so, verse 4, Boaz says, so I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, then tell me that I may know that there is no, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and then I come after you. So if this guy will pay whatever is outstanding on a debt that's attached to this piece of property and redeem it, then it will belong to him and he can use it. And I get the impression that he would very much like that. We don't know exactly how old this guy is, but since he is unmarried, he must be fairly young. But then he says, oh yeah, I'll redeem it. So he wants it. He would like to have the piece of property. But Boaz then said, okay, the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. So this is where Boaz drops the legal reality. If you want to redeem this property, you also have to get married to Naomi and give her a son. that can then be the heir of the property in the name of her husband, the late husband. Now, that is where this unnamed redeemer comes to a line he doesn't want to cross. So the redeemer said, I'm not going to redeem it for myself, lest it impair my own inheritance. You take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So he makes the objection that was understood. If I do this, if I get married to her, and we only have one boy, then he will be the heir of her late husband, not my heir. I'll be left heirless. I'm not going to take that chance. I'm not going to risk it. So, no, I won't redeem the property after all. You can have it. Now, there is, in the Mosaic Code given by God, the procedure that was supposed to happen in this levirate marriage situation. The widow of the dead man, if the first redeemer refuses to marry her, then that is supposed to be an insult, not to her, but to her late husband. And so she is supposed to go up into his presence, spit in his face out of disgust that he would insult her husband in that way, and then rip his sandal off of his foot. And from that moment forward, that man will be known as the shoeless guy. And it was supposed to be a negative that he was so selfish that he would not do the right thing for his family's inheritance lines. Well, it's been a few hundred years, probably about 250 or so years, since Moses gave that direction. And things have changed. Remember, we're in the period of the judges. Everybody does as they see fit in their own eyes. And so some of the things from Moses' day have lost their original meaning. Verse 7. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. So there's no negativity in here at all. Not such as what was originally intended. The guy just reaches down, pulls off his sandal, probably just temporarily, hands it off to Boaz and says, no, you can have the redemption right yourself. I'm out of it. And that's all that the elders needed to see, is the handing off of the sandal and the verbalization of, no, I don't want to redeem. So then Boaz gets to do the redemption. Verse 9, then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. Now, some more modern people have a problem with this being described as him buying Ruth as his wife. But remember that this is redemption of the line of inheritance. And he is paying the price for the property, whatever was still owed on it. He will also, more than likely, give a big dowry to Ruth's mother-in-law, because she's the responsible adult in that family line. Ruth left her mom and dad, so they're no longer tied into her. So he will probably pay several years' wages into the hands of Naomi, and then eventually that will come into Ruth's possession as an inheritance from Naomi. But he is basically making it clear, I will do everything that's needed for Ruth to become my wife. Verse 11, then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May he who is make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. So this is a blessing of the time period to basically say, may she be like the matriarchs of the Israeli nation, the two legal wives of Jacob who became the mothers of Israel. So may she be very blessed. May you, Boaz, act worthily in Ephrathah, that's the general region around Bethlehem, and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that he who is will give you by this young woman. That's a family blessing, because this is the line from Judah that Boaz and probably his cousin Elimelech came from, is the Perez line. So they're offering blessings and good wishes on the day of this betrothal. Verse number 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And don't you imagine that would have been quite the wedding ceremony with all the community invited. Boaz seems to be a very high-placed individual in the community, very well-to-do, but has never been married. So I think a lot of people would have been excited by that reality. And then Ruth is this foreigner that has sworn off her old life and her old world and embraced this new community as her own, shown great devotion to her mother-in-law, Naomi, and has been a hard worker and a worthy individual, a very honorable lady. And so she's going to become a very special part of the community here. Must have been quite the big blowout for these two to get married. Now, it then immediately starts talking about babies that are born to them. Now, I'm going to throw out something for you to chew on. I can't absolutely prove any of this, but it does seem reasonable to understand from the requirements of the levirate marriage. And that is, the first baby boy that is born to Boaz and Ruth is supposed to be the legal son of Ruth and Mahlon, the legal heir of the Elimelech line, and therefore the one that will take the piece of property as his own when he becomes an adult, that came into or was redeemed by Boaz. The next son after that that is born will be the heir of Boaz and will inherit all of his family line's material possessions. And then they will have other children beyond that. We don't know how many boys and girls they ended up having. So my suspicion is that when we continue in verse 13, that we focus on a later son that is born to the couple and not the first one. So he went into her, and he who is gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, blessed be he who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. And so Naomi took the child, laid him on her lap, and became his nurse. Now, the way it's presented, it could be that's their firstborn son, but as I said, I think that firstborn son would have been counted as the son of the Elimelech line. This sounds very much like this is the son of the Boaz line. And so the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. And they named him Obed, which is built on the word for work. And he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And that is why this book is so important. This book is the story, it's the love story, if you will, of David's great-grandparents. And that is why it needs to be talked about in Israel, because David becomes the king of Israel eventually, from the tribe of Judah. And so because this is the line of Perez, then we have this genealogy at the end of the book that starts with Perez. Now, these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon was a leader of Judah tribe at the time of the Exodus. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon ends up being married to Rahab. Salmon fathered Boaz. There may actually be some other generations in here, because we know that there's some time that passes between the Exodus and the conquest and the time of Ruth. And so one of the things that we have here in genealogies is sometimes the idea of fathering has the more generic sense of producing. So it could be several generations that end up being produced. Book of Matthew has a genealogy list that you can compare it and see that there are some generations that are skipped. And it's not because they weren't important, but just common procedure sometimes to shorten the genealogy lists, maybe as a memorization tool. But anyway, Salmon ends up becoming the ancestor Boaz, who is the person in this story. Boaz fathered Obed, Obed fathered Jesse, and then Jesse fathered David. And so that finishes the story of Ruth and the great-grandparents of King David. So now we can go back to Judges, where we left off. And we're going to go to Judges chapter number 8, right at the end of the chapter. Because I was guessing that the story of Ruth happens sometime during the years of Gideon's judgeship. And this is what it says in verse 28 of Judges chapter 8. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. So that was the Gideon story at the beginning of his leadership, how he broke the Midian oppression of Israel. Then it says, the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. So I think that the story of Ruth comes in that period of time, probably closer to the end of it. Then we find out a little bit more about Gideon in his later years. Yerubbaal, the son of Joash, that's his nickname, went and lived in his own house. Now, Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. Now, are the Israelis supposed to be multiplying wives in themselves? The answer is no. So somewhere along the way, Gideon went off the track that God had intended. Now, why do they have multiple women for leaders? It's the matter of making alliances and contracts and business arrangements. So he's wheeling and dealing clearly in leadership. He doesn't just simply have full-fledged wives. He also has concubines on the side. Verse 31, his concubine who was in Shechem also bore him a son, and he, meaning Gideon, called his name Abimelech, which is Hebrew for my dad is king. So somewhere in his later leadership, during those 40 years, Gideon started rethinking whether or not he shouldn't have taken that job as king over the Israelis. And he names his illegitimate son, my daddy is the king. But then he dies. Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age, was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, at Ophrah of the Abiezrites. And you know what comes after a good judge dies.